Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In October 1991, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a confirmation hearing to appoint Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court. 2 days before the Senate was scheduled to vote on Thomas's confirmation, sexual harassment charges surfaced. Oklahoma law professor Anita Hill accused her former boss of sexual harassment. In the early 1980s, Anita Hill was Clarence Thomas's special assistant at the Department of Education and the EEOC. Anita Hill's testimony was a watershed moment for women in politics. At the time, sexual harassment was still viewed as typical male behavior that many women dealt with in silence. In her new book, Win, Women, Win, Emily's List founder Ellen Malcolm writes, quote, Anita Hill's courage in publicly making her charges unleashed years of pent-up rage in many working women. They believed Clarence Thomas's behavior was horrible and that he should not be on the United States Supreme Court. Quite simply, they believed Anita Hill, and they wanted to know where the women senators were who could defend her. At the time, there were only two women in the Senate, one Republican and one Democrat. Anita Hill's testimony became a defining moment in the rise of women in American politics. And joining me today to discuss where we've come since 1985 and how far we have to go is Ellen Malcolm. She's the founder and chair of Emily's List. In 1985, Ellen and a small group of friends decided to change the absence of women in elected office by developing a new political strategy. To give women candidates credibility and the resources to actually win a campaign, they decided to raise early money, and they called the organization Emily's List. Early money is like yeast. It makes the dough rise. Her new book, Win, Women, Win, recounts the last 30 years of their work to get pro-choice Democratic women in office. And Ellen Malcolm joins me in studio. Hi, Ellen. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. It's great to be back in the Bay Area.
Well, it's great to have you. And your book is really interesting because you provide so much information about what goes on behind the scenes of these campaigns. We did a show last year about the new documentary about Anita Hill, and it was great to be reminded that out of the 14 members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, there was not one single woman, and the men in the U.S. Senate were mostly completely clueless about sexual harassment.
You know, it was Mad Men time, you know, like the television show. I mean, women and men had such a different idea about what was appropriate workplace behavior. You know, the women were always getting patted on the fanny, pushed into corners, told their jobs would count if and they would find all these ways to cope with it. You know, they'd make jokes, they'd stay away from the person that was coming after him. But men just thought, oh, you know, that's the way the world is and it's no big deal. So you had this total dichotomy, a gender-based dichotomy on what is sexual harassment. Along comes Anita Hill. The issue is blown up for the first time. You know, it was the forbidden topic. You just never discussed it. And all of a sudden, on national TV, there it was, sexual harassment, claims, differences of opinions, and, of course, no women there representing the women's views. So, you know, we love a representative democracy. We think it works because it brings in lots of people's perspectives and points of view. But we saw with the Thomas Hill hearings that it wasn't working for women. And women got furious and said, we're going to change the world. And a lot of them came to Emily's List, and we did in the Year of the Woman, 1992 elections.
And this is really important because, as you point out in your book, the full Senate was eager to proceed with the vote on Clarence Thomas's confirmation. Barbara Mikulski urged a delay in the vote, but she was the only Democratic woman in the Senate. So she was the lone voice out of 100 senators. And then on the House side, on the very day of the vote for the confirmation, you had seven Democratic women, including Representatives Barbara Boxer, she was a representative at the time, Louise Slaughter, Nita Lowey, and Eleanor Holmes Norton. And they marched over to the Senate side of the Capitol to tell the senators that they needed to take Anita Hill's allegations seriously and reopen the hearings.
And they were shut out. The Democratic caucus said, no, we're not going to meet with you. You know, you're basically foreigners. You don't belong to the United States Senate and the Democratic caucus, and we're not going to talk to you. So, again, there was that wonderful picture of Barbara Boxer leading the congresswomen over and, you know, knocking on the door, trying to get in. And the women really tried to raise the issue. It wasn't, though, until Nina Totenberg from National Public Radio broke the story and it all blew up that the Senate Judiciary Committee, that was, by the way, chaired at the time by Joe Biden, said, okay, we've got to deal with it. And they put it up on television. It's a wonderful story about California women. And Dianne Feinstein, who was running for the Senate for the first time, along with Barbara Boxer, had this great line. There were two women out of 100 senators, and Dianne said, 2% is fine for low-fat milk, but it's not good for a representative democracy.
And then this is the other important point you make in your book about Clarence Thomas. On October 15th, 1991, he was confirmed in the Senate 52-48, the narrowest margin of approval in more than 100 years. When the roll was called in the Senate, you heard the word Mr. 52 times before the first woman was called. One can only imagine, you write, the result if women had made up more than 2% of the United States Senate. Maybe Clarence Thomas wouldn't have been confirmed.
Well, I think that's a very real possibility. But what that whole hearing did was really send a shockwave through the political world. And it played out very interestingly in the first primary for the Senate in March. The Thomas Hill hearings were in October. In March, we had the first primaries for the 1992 elections. And Carol Moseley Braun, who was the recorder of deeds in Chicago, was so angry at what had happened, she decided she was going to run for the United States Senate. Well, in the Democratic primary was the current Democratic United States Senator, Alan Dixon. He was being challenged by a wealthy trial lawyer. And Carol, who had no money, virtually no campaign, was also in this primary race. And lo and behold, the two men in the race started spending millions of dollars attacking each other, one ad getting worse than the next. They went to debates. They were slamming each other in debates. And meanwhile, in the debate stage was wonderful Carol Moseley Braun, smart, warm, attractive, just in there holding her own, calling them, you know, what was wrong with the Senate, why there weren't enough women. And in March, the voters chose, and lo and behold, Carol Moseley Braun, who spent, I think, about $100,000, defeated a Democratic woman, a senator, Alan Dixon, who had voted to confirm Clarence Thomas. She defeated him in the primary. Women were elected at all levels in Illinois. Women running for judges. People would just vote for all the women on the ticket. And so it was the first election after Thomas Hill, and it was like a cannon went off. All of a sudden, the political world is like, whoa, this is serious stuff. Women are on fire, and we better be careful.
And at the time, you write that because none of the 14 members of the Senate Judiciary Committee were women, it made women realize, wait, why are there so few women in politics?
From a marketing perspective, from Emily's List perspective, it couldn't have been better because we were running around trying to get people to join. And what you do with Emily's List, you become a member, and we basically are like your political staff. We go out and identify for you viable pro-choice Democratic women running in those days for House, Senate, and governor. We send you a profile about the candidates we're supporting and ask you to write checks to whoever you want. So we answer your questions. We say, who's out there? Who is a realistic chance of winning so you're not wasting your money? Here's what they stand for. Here's what's happening in the race. And then you make your own decision. Well, it was perfect for this situation because women all across the country were like, well, who's running for the Senate? This is before the internet. It was tough trying to find out who was out there. You certainly couldn't figure out who was a realistic candidate or what they stood for in either the House or the Senate in those days. So Emily's List was on 60 Minutes. They had a piece on us. We were in the news all over the place. It's a focal point for this. And we ended up raising millions of dollars for women running in 1992, elected four Democratic women to the United States Senate, 20 new Democratic women into the House. In 1988, there were only 12 in the entire House. In one election, we added 20. It was historic because women got mad. They realized there were no women. They found a way that they could change that, and they did.
You also talk about how the Democratic Party was really failing to recognize women as candidates in the mid-90s. In the mid-80s. In 85, the Democratic Party had never elected a single woman to the Senate in her own right, not just because her husband passed away, for example. So how did this inspire the creation of Emily's List?
Well, we were actually furious because we knew all kinds of let me describe we a little bit. It's myself. I had worked at the National Women's Political Caucus on the ERA in the 1970s. So I was active with the national political women's scene. And we would hear these stories all the time of women in the state legislature, for example, and they'd say, my congressman is retiring. I think I'll run for the United States House of Representatives. They go to the old boys network, the traditional Democratic funders, and they'd say, I'm in office now. I have a political base. I have a track record. I've done well on these issues. Will you give me money to support me? And the guys would say, you're never going to win. You can't raise any money. So I'm not going to give you any money. And, of course, that was this vicious circle for women. They couldn't break out of it. The guys wouldn't give them any money. And then because they couldn't get any money, they couldn't win. And so then the guys would say, I told you so. Women can't win. So we were angry, and we were fed up, and we said, we have to figure out how to raise early money to give our women candidates credibility. If we could just get some money in early on, maybe the guys would take them seriously, and then they'd come in and support them. So Emily, our funny name, Emily's List, stands for Early Money is Like Yeast, because we make the dough rise. And that's what we do for our women candidates. We are the venture capitalists, political venture capitalists. We come in early, we help them in the beginning, and then we carry them through all the way to Election Day.
And just to give listeners a little more background on you, in 1968, during the Democratic presidential primary in Pennsylvania, you worked for Eugene McCarthy, the anti-war senator from Minnesota. And then in the summer of 1970, you moved to Washington and worked with Common Cause, the group that still, now in 2016, works for campaign finance and election reform. And the group's first goal was to end the Vietnam War.
And that's what motivated me to go there. I was a child of the 60s, and I wanted to end the war in Vietnam. And that seemed like a citizens' lobby that had just been created by John Gardner was a wonderful way to do that. And so it was my first national organizing effort. It taught me a lot about organizing and how it works on Capitol Hill, and gave me an opportunity to start a couple of things within the organization. All those sort of pieces came together and helped me start Emily's List in 1985.
I'm speaking with Ellen Malcolm. She is the founder of Emily's List. She's out with a new book, When Women Win, Emily's List and the Rise of Women in American Politics. Tonight at 7:30, Ellen will be speaking at the Hillside Club in Berkeley as part of the Berkeley Arts and Letters series. And then tomorrow at 6:30, she will be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, do you have any questions for Ellen Malcolm? What do you think it will take to see gender parity in Congress? What do you remember about the 60s, 70s, early 80s when there were hardly any women in Congress? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. What actually changes with more women in politics? And if you've ever been involved in a campaign, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So in the summer of 1970, you were working with Common Cause when they were trying to work for campaign finance. And when you look at where we are today, wow.
It's a mess.
Yeah, you've seen so many changes.
Yeah.
I mean, back then, it was hard enough for a woman to raise money to buy ads, for example. Today, you know, we've heard that some politicians spend almost every day raising money.
Well, they do, and they have for years. And now with Citizens United,
right,
where any wealthy person can write a big check for unlimited amounts, it's very difficult to compete. It's just the wild, wild west out there now, and I really hope when we get the Supreme Court and the new nominee comes that they will stop and relook at what has happened as a result of Citizens United, because it's just terrible. Right now we have campaigns we're always working with. We're trying to help to put together a good campaign. But this outside money now is dwarfing what the campaigns spend. So you don't really even have control over what it is you want to talk about to the voters. And, of course, we all know there are all these dirty tricks and mischaracterizing what people are saying. So it's not healthy for our democracy, in my opinion. And there's a lot of the old campaign reformer in me. I have to say, I think Emily's List is a wonderful way to have campaign finance reform, and it was from the very beginning. In 1986, in our first election, the PAC world really dominated where the money came. And a political action committee, or PAC, would raise a big campaign war chest from its supporters. They almost always had a legislative agenda. And they would dole out these contributions trying to get votes on Capitol Hill. There was a limit of about $5,000 per election. Well, we said, we need to just support our women candidates. We want to involve small contributors. And we essentially reinvented political fundraising by creating a donor network, saying to the members, write up, the purpose of Emily's List is to give you information. You write checks to whoever you like. So when Barbara Mikulski ran for the Senate in 1986, I would explain to our new potential members, if we're a PAC, we can give $5,000. If I get 1,000 members of Emily's List and you all decide to write your $100 check for Barbara Mikulski, we could raise from individuals $100,000 as opposed to that $5,000 limit. So we got away from the special interest-driven money. We don't go up to Capitol Hill and lobby on all these issues. It's basically a way of involving small donors in politics and giving them political power. We now see it all the time on the internet. We see it through Act Blue and bundling and candidates raising that. But at the end of the day, Emily's List reinvented this new way for small contributors to have power in the process, and I think that's a healthy campaign reform.
We did a show with Jane Mayer, a reporter with The New Yorker, about her book Dark Money a couple of weeks ago. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And she really did an amazing job of exposing the Koch brothers' network, a lot of these names that we've never heard of. This election cycle, they're expected to spend about $900 million.
It's unbelievable. And they are reshaping not only what we learn about candidates, but all kinds of messages and how we think about our government and how we think about issues. And, you know, right now there's incredible anger in the electorate out there. And one of the reasons, I think, is that the conservative forces like the Koch brothers have really behind the scenes spent a lot of money basically trying to destroy our trust in government. And they've done a very good job. You know, when I was growing up, we had a lot of respect for the people in power, respect for the president. You know, now we see that it's just diminished until we get to this presidential campaign and it's like a food fight.
Literally.
So, you know, a lot of that has been a long-term plan that some of these right-wing, conservative, wealthy people have invested in. And they literally have changed how we view ourselves and our country and our leaders. And I think it's really unfortunate. It has made a very toxic environment out there. And as we know, almost impossible to get things done.
I'm speaking with Ellen Malcolm, founder of Emily's List. We have a question about money and politics. Let's hear from Sarah in San Francisco. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question because I noticed recently that Emily's List is the fourth largest contributor to the Hillary Clinton campaign. And I guess I'm curious, you know, how money is allocated, because I think good women candidates are great. But Hillary Clinton supported cluster bombs when she was in the Senate, the Iraq War. She's been praised by Dick Cheney and Kissinger. when she was she paid her staffers in the Senate 72 cents an hour, even though in 2014 she said women were making 70 cents to a dollar for men. Plus, she just took $250,000 out of one of her PACs, even though she's a multimillionaire. So I think I would rather, I would rather not contribute to Emily's list, and I like to contribute directly to charities that I can.
Sarah, we can't hear you all that well, but do you have a question?
I think with Emily's list.
Sorry about Sarah's line. So her question is, why would you back candidates that already have such a huge chest, like Hillary Clinton, who's getting a lot of money from Wall Street?
Well, I think it's Sarah, I'm assuming you're feeling the burn. Obviously, as an organization that elects pro-choice Democratic women, we are thrilled with what Hillary Clinton is doing running for president. We were the first organization to support her in 2008 and again in this election, and our members are sending her their contributions from all across the country. We are doing a lot of conversation with women voters, which we started actually here in California with Dianne Feinstein's race in 1994, because we know that when the gender gap basically shows that women are the most progressive political force in this country, and when we motivate them to go out and win, it's very good not only for our women candidates but for Democrats up and down the ticket. So I think it's totally appropriate and understandable and expected that Emily's list is coming in for Hillary Clinton. I'm very struck in this conversation as we move through the very respectful and polite Democratic debates, that there's a lot of conversation, and Hillary will continue this, I think, in the general election, about issues that affect women and families in a way that we've never heard before. It was Hillary that started the conversation about equal pay for equal work, paid leave. Her Social Security provisions take into account the fact that women have often interrupted work lives. Their patterns are different than men when they're building up their retirement chest because women drop out to take care of their kids. And I think it's wonderful. You see the difference of having a woman in the presidential campaign, bringing in a lot of issues that are not usually discussed, but as we know, really impact families every single day of their lives. So I think it's a great example of the advantages of having a woman in the race and hearing a woman's perspective on some of the big economic issues, the job creation issues that are confronting the country.
What do you think about the current debate around Hillary and Bernie Sanders? I mean, a lot of people say that we should really focus on the issues. And I just wanted to fact check what Sarah brought up about cluster bombs. I just want to make sure. And there's a headline over at Democratic Luntz. Hillary Clinton voted to continue cluster bombing civilians. So a lot of people.
Frank Luntz is a.
No, it's not. Oh, not Frank Luntz. No. Not Frank Luntz. It's a Daily Coast written by Democratic Luntz is what it's called.
I don't know about the cluster bombs. Look, we know who Hillary Clinton is. We know that she restored relationships with countries all across the world after 8 years of the Bush administration. This is a woman who understands the complexities of international relations, reaches out and rebuilds all kinds of relationships and respect, and does it at the same time while promoting the interests of women. She's tough enough to protect us in a time of terrorism, but I think is very well versed on the complexities of what we need to do to protect this country. So I think, there are little issues that come up in massive spending bills and all that. I don't want to get into all those issues. I think we've seen Hillary in action for many years. We know who she is as a fighter for this country, and we know that she has the expertise to understand this very complex, messy international environment that we're existing in.
You supported her when she ran against President Obama, but then you supported Obama.
I did.
And would you support Bernie Sanders if he gets the nomination?
I expect Hillary will be getting the nomination, but I don't think – I mean, I think we would, or I would personally, because I want to make sure that we have the strongest candidate who looks like it's going to be running against Donald Trump. And, you know, I think it's an important thing to talk about 2008. You know, that was a hard-fought primary, and there were many of us, our hopes were dashed when Hillary did not get the nomination. But boy, we came right back and worked for Barack Obama. And I was out there working, and Emily's List was motivating women voters in critical states like North Carolina and New Hampshire that were toss-up states for both him, helped us elect Jean Shaheen and Kay Hagan to the Senate in the same election. So we all came together, and we came together because we wanted to make sure there was a Democrat in the White House. I think it's going to happen again, and I think though I do believe Hillary will be the nominee, I certainly hope all the Bernie supporters will come over too, because the last thing we want is Donald Trump or Ted Cruz sitting in the White House and making appointments to the Supreme Court and trying to conduct foreign policy in this terribly complicated world.
Ellen Malcolm is founder of Emily's List, an organization that works to support and promote pro-choice women Democrats. Her new book is Win Women Win, Emily's List and the Rise of Women in American Politics. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always encourage new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, please send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply leave a comment there on the website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the quality and safety of drinking water in the U.S. The Flint water crisis has raised so many questions about our drinking water systems. Roughly 96 million people could be drinking water with unsafe levels of lead, according to the American Water Works Association. So what will it take to overhaul our water infrastructure? It could cost $1 trillion over 25 years. We're also putting shows together this week with Sally Denton. She's author of The Profiteers, Bechdel and the Men Who Built the World. And we're going to do a show about the new documentary Trapped, which takes a look at what abortion providers across the country are currently facing. Today, I am joined by Ellen Malcolm, the founder of Emily's List. She's out with a new book, When Women Win, Emily's List and the Rise of Women in American Politics. Ellen will be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley, and tomorrow, that's at 7:30. Tomorrow at 6:30, she'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. In 1985, 5% of the 435 elected officials in the House were women. Only 2 of the 100 senators were women, and both were Republicans. Well, a lot has changed since then, but we still have a long ways to go. So what are your thoughts on this issue? What really changes when we get more women in politics? What questions do you have for Ellen? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll talk more about Hillary Clinton in a couple of minutes, but I first wanted to ask you just about what happened to the Republican Party, because in your book, you write about moderate Republicans who were very pro-choice. And when you wrote about this, I was thinking about Prescott Bush, the grandfather of Jeb and George W. Bush, who was an active supporter of Planned Parenthood. In 1947, he was treasurer of the group's first national fundraising campaign. And then how quickly we forget that George H.W. was such an advocate of family planning, his nickname was Rubbers. And then came Ronald Reagan, and he did a complete 180.
You know, when I was at the National Women's Political Caucus in the 70s, there were a wonderful group of moderate feminist Republican women who believed in the ERA and believed in the decision of Roe v. Wade, were very active in Planned Parenthood and whatever. And as the conservatives began to take over the party in 1980, they began to push those women out. And as the elections took place over the years, there are virtually no more Republican moderate women. In fact, my very own mother, who was a do-or-die Republican when I began Emily's List, ended up moving over to the Democratic Party because she was so horrified with all the conversations about family planning, abortion, and Planned Parenthood. So they've really pushed women out. But the most shocking thing for me, actually, even doing the book, was to look at the difference in progress in electing women to office on the Democratic side than from the Republican side. You know, right now we look at the Congress and we see Nancy Pelosi as our wonderful Democratic leader, and Bay Area's got women elected all around the circle of the Bay Area. But the truth of the matter is that almost all that progress has been on the Democratic side. We began doing House races in 1988, and women, Democratic women, were about 5% of the Democrats. Women were about 5% of the Republicans. But today, Democrats are about a third of the women are about a third of the Democrats elected to the Congress. On the Republican side, they've gone from 5% to still under 10%. So it's a flat line. Republican women have made no progress electing women in 30 years. It's a scandal, and they should be ashamed of that.
Well, and so how do you see this playing out? Because the Republican women who are now going to Washington, like Joni Ernst, for example, mm-hmm. from Iowa, are hardcore anti-choice.
They are hardcore extreme conservatives. The moderate Republican women that used to hold office are no longer there. And they basically don't do anything on the Republican side to bring any more women in. You know, so just think about what it means. The Republicans get together. They talk about what they're going to do about Planned Parenthood. 9 out of 10 people in the room are men. They don't even understand how the female body works, apparently. You know, they make ridiculous claims like you can't get pregnant from rape. And so there are no moderating voices on their side. And I think it's one of the reasons we have these extreme policies. They would do better themselves if they started encouraging more women on the Republican side to come in. I don't think they're ever going to be as progressive like Democrats. They're going to be Republicans. But there is a long way to go on that side to get even somewhere near the middle of the political spectrum, and women would help them do that.
Well, I remember when John McCain was running for president, Republicans did not want to embrace the extreme position of being against abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. But that's what you have now with Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. They support overturning Roe, and they oppose exceptions for rape and incest. And it's just shocking to me that this doesn't get more attention in the media. Donald Trump and John Kasich support exceptions. But what are your thoughts just about how things have moved so far to the right, especially on this issue?
Well, I think it's just terrible, because it's one thing to do these political, you know, try to get support, which the Republicans have been trying to do. You know, they've got a strong religious element of political support, and they've been catering to that. That's why George Father Bush dropped his apparent nickname and went over and became more conservative on women's health issues. Because the Christian Coalition back in the 80s had taken over. But that's, you know, it's one thing for political rhetoric. Look at what they are doing to Planned Parenthood. And Donald Trump, I got to say, he really kind of told the story of the absurdity in the debate a couple of weeks ago when he oddly stood up for Planned Parenthood. He was a little off Republican message. He said they do some really good work. They do good things for women's health. They do a lot of screening and things like that. But I think we should cut their funds off. Well, in fact, there are no federal funds going into Planned Parenthood to pay for abortions. That is against the law, has been for decades. All those Republican candidates are aware of that. So these attacks are nothing but political games to basically hurt an organization that provides essential health care for millions of women across the country.
Ted Cruz is from Texas, and the Washington Post had a story last month about poor women having more babies because of Planned Parenthood closures. According to the piece, since Texas slashed funding to Planned Parenthood in 2011, more than half of the state's abortion clinics have shut down completely. Researchers looked at fertility trends among women who qualified for birth control through the state's public family planning programs in the 2 years before and after lawmakers booted Planned Parenthood from its payroll. And it found that between 2011 and 2014, the number of these births covered by Medicaid climbed 27%. So because the clinics are closing, more poor women are having babies.
That's right. It's a nonsensical policy decision, and it just shows it's a political football. And unfortunately, I think what you see the Republicans in the states now just trying to outdo each other on the more extreme position they can come up with. So, you know, I think the answer to that is to elect more Democratic women to office, obviously, because it's the Democratic women that are the strong defenders, but so are Democratic men. And we've got to invest in taking back control of the states and undoing these ridiculous policies that are put in place.
Now, out here on the West Coast, we're a little disconnected from Washington. And I just wonder, you know, why aren't there more Democratic women raising hell over this issue? Are they in Washington and they're just not invited onto the Sunday shows? Are they talking and we're not hearing them?
They are absolutely the strongest asset we have. And we saw that play out on the health care bill when it was being passed. There was a lot of conversation about trying to prohibit funds for this and that, and they were a wall that kept that from happening. Led by Nancy Pelosi in the House and the Democratic women in the Senate, Barbara Boxer played a particularly key role in that. So when the legislation comes up and there's going to be a fight about it, they are always there, and thank God they are. A lot of what you see now is being passed by a Republican majority, and it's not going to get anywhere, and everybody knows it. They're just using women as a political football. But the critical element to that piece in the equation is the President of the United States, Barack Obama, who has his veto pen, and everybody knows he does. It's another reason why we have to have a Democrat in the White House. If the Republicans win in the presidential election and we have one of these Republican presidents, any of the group that we've seen running, they are going to pass this legislation right and left, and it's going to be devastating for all women.
And a lot of the restrictions that we're seeing are being passed at the state levels. Jane Mayer, in her book Dark Money, exposed the fact that the Koch network is highly, highly effective at the state level, to the point where they even took a lot of moderate Republicans by surprise. They didn't see these attacks coming from the right and all of this money being poured into the states from outside donors. And so what we have right now is 70% of state legislatures, more than 60% of governors, 55% of attorneys general and secretaries of state are in Republicans' hands. How does this affect the work that you're doing at the state level? Because that's really, really important, especially when you're talking about abortion restrictions.
We've been doing recruiting and training of women to run at the local level for some years and have worked with Emerge, a group that comes out of San Francisco, as a matter of fact, and other organizations. But it's a drop in the bucket compared to what the Koch brothers are able to do. And it's something that we as Democrats need to learn a lesson from. We go through this every 10 years. Because every 10 years we do a new census and we redraw all the district lines for both the states and the federal level. And whichever party is in control of that process really determines how many Democrats and how many Republicans are going to win. Unfortunately, the Democrats, since we never seem to have as much money as the Republicans, always seem to wait to the last minute and make this token gesture of, oh, my goodness, we better do state legislative races. We can't do that. We need to have a long-term plan. We need to build up in the states. But at the end of the day, it's another example of where this wealthy, unseen, unfettered money and investment from a small group of very radically conservative billionaires is changing what's happening in our country.
Ellen Malcolm is founder of Emily's List, an organization that works to support and get pro-choice Democratic women elected. She's author of the new book, When Women Win, Emily's List and the Rise of Women in American Politics. Tonight at 7:30, Ellen will be speaking at the Hillside Club in Berkeley, and tomorrow at 6:30, she will be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you are represented by a woman, what changes have you seen? Why is this issue important? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rose, very much. And thank you, ma'am, for spearheading this very important movement. It's a wonderful movement. I've got a cousin named Emily, and she's just thrilled that you called it that.
Good.
Anyway, two things. One is there was a reporter at one of the local television stations who, when covering your national dinner, your annual fundraising dinner, dismissively called it a philanthropic group. and so I wrote him a little note about, you know, your reporting is usually good, but you've completely missed the point, dear. Anyway, the other thing is I had called your organization because San Francisco currently has a mayor who appears extremely bought, and he really needs a independent woman to run against him to expose these sweetheart deals that he's unnecessarily made with corporations that have more money than God, pardon the expression. And I was told that you actually don't do local endorsements. Is there a chance that in the future you'll be able to help us clean house by starting to propose local candidates?
Well, we've been expanding our work a lot at the state and local level and are weighing in on a lot of mayors' races, but it's not the same political, not philanthropic, force that we have at the congressional and governorship. And the reason is pretty obvious. I mean, there are just so many state legislative races, so many mayor's races. So there's a limit to what we can do, but we can come in and endorse and support. And we have done that very effectively. For example, we've been a big supporter of the mayor of Houston who came in, and East Parker, who did a wonderful job as mayor of Houston. So it's new territory for us, but we are involved, and I know the women of San Francisco have been very active politically, so go for it.
You talked about Emerge, which trains women and tries to get more women to run for office. Are there any groups like Emily's List that solely focus on local politicians to give them support?
There are a few organizations that we support. They are not officially part of Emily's List that work in the states. For example, Annie's List in Texas. That does very similar kinds of things of what we do, and we help them with training and are supportive of them and their candidates, and we think it's great. The more we do to get people involved and paying attention to these state local races, I think the better it's going to be. And the more women we're going to have ready to run as we move up the ladder. You know, we've had tremendous success here in California. But it's no secret that a lot of the women we've helped elect are now nearing retirement age. I think 8 of the women in the California congressional delegation now are 70 or over. So, you know, it's going to be sometime pretty soon that we're going to have to find some more women to run for those offices. And so we need to keep more and more women in. Term limits has been a real challenge here in your state. We're always out there having to find new women and get them involved. And I'll tell you one thing, Katie, and you might do this and have your friends do this too. We find that women are just too stand-back-ish about running for office. We've done a lot of training, and they say, you know, nobody asked me to run. Well, nobody asks the guys to run. They practically are born deciding they're going to run. So what we always say is when we see women that are interested, we want you to run. And just reaching out to your friends and neighbors who are smart and involved, ask them to run for office. They may never have thought about it. They may have just needed a little encouragement. So give them some encouragement.
Well, you have a really interesting story about Elizabeth Warren in your book. And Emily's List reached out to Elizabeth Warren and encouraged her to run. And she wasn't convinced. And so Senator Patty Murray called Elizabeth. And you quote Elizabeth Warren in your book saying, quote, "I immediately started out with my long list of why I'm not prepared to be senator, about why I'm not qualified right now," I said. "I haven't learned about this and I haven't learned about that." It's such a woman thing to say.
It's such a woman's thing to say. I always laugh, I say, when we talk to the candidates, you don't have to pass an SAT test here. You know, you can learn a lot. We can help you learn. But nobody's going to be an expert in everything. Don't worry about it. We can get you through all this. And you know, it's just the way we are. We're earnest, and we need to do a good job, and we think we have to know everything. No, you don't have to know everything. You have to bring your passion and your value system. And actually, at the end of the day, that's what voters want to hear about. Who are you as a person? We know you're not going to understand every single issue, but how are you going to approach the issue? How are you going to make a decision?
And as Senator Murray pointed out, you don't really have men say, "Well, I'm not prepared to be senator. I'm not qualified right now. I haven't learned this yet."
Right. Never. Never, ever.
And so Emily's List supported.
I think it sort of makes me think of Donald Trump, as a matter of fact. Every time somebody asks him a question about any policy position, and I can tell, he just basically attacks them and, you know, never says what the position is. "We're not going to teach you how to do that. We'll help you a lot more than that." But that's certainly a different viewpoint of how you answer questions about things you may not know the answer to.
And he barely says anything. I mean, if a woman were running and barely said anything, would the media let her get away with that?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because credibility is still one of the big tests for women, and as it should be when you're running for president of the United States. And no, people would go after Hillary Clinton if she didn't know the answers to anything. Now, fortunately, Hillary knows so many answers to things that it's almost more important to get Hillary to talk about her value system and how she gets to those positions. But yeah, you can tell right off the bat listening to her. She knows what she's talking about. She's a very informed and dedicated public servant, and it's not the Trump view of just attacking anyone who asks him.
We have another question about Hillary before we end. Let's hear from Jennifer in San Francisco. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. I appreciate the show, and I really appreciate Emily's List, and I'm grateful that you're having the guest on, Ms. Malcolm.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. But I wanted to say that I was disheartened by your response to the question about Hillary and carpet bombing. And I find this a lot when people who support Hillary are asked direct questions about, you know, what she's done, things that are maybe a little more questionable for people or concern people. The responses tend to be that she's an excellent stateswoman, that she's done so much, that these questions shouldn't be asked. And I just wanted to comment that was the way I felt about your response.
Oh, I didn't mean to say the questions shouldn't be asked. What I meant to say was that Hillary has done so much in so many venues. And at the end of the day, I think her depth of understanding of these issues and the complexities is something very important in this time of terrorism. Let me give you another sort of behind-the-scenes sense of what Hillary is like. Hillary once said to me in about 2007, she said, every time I go into one of these foreign countries and the host government is putting together my schedule, when I was first lady, now I'm senator all the way up, and she still does it, I insist with meeting with the women leaders. And I just, my mind was blown, because at one fell swoop, Hillary Clinton is basically saying to third world foreign leaders in the Middle East, in Africa, you better go find the women that are doing work in your country. And I'm sure they were like, oh my God, somebody find me a woman leader. I don't even know who one is. So they were forcing them to acknowledge the women. They were forcing them to bring them together. Hillary was then meeting with those women and encouraging them. She was putting them in the media spotlight, so you couldn't just have those women disappear into the night without the international media knowing about it. Just an incredible strategic move at many levels.
Is it possible to praise that, and then as someone like you, Ellen, who got involved during the anti-war movement in Vietnam, I mean, I don't know where you stand on foreign policy today, but can you also, if you disagree with her about, for example, we just got an email from a guest who's talking about regime change in Libya, Hillary's support for the coup in Honduras, her push for an uninvited no-fly zone in Syria. People are frustrated because they feel like supporters of Hillary aren't criticizing her foreign policy views, even though they might disagree with them.
Well, I think, you know, the Iraq vote is one example that she said she made a mistake on. But let's stop for a minute. This isn't Hillary versus nobody. This is Hillary, you know, versus a whole bunch of other candidates out there. So the question is, who knows the most? Who knows the complexities of dealing with these issues? Who knows how to keep us safe? Not how do you give a speech about an issue or how you cast a vote in the United States Senate, but how do you make tough decisions about these issues? You know, there are going to be times when things don't come out the way she had hoped. It's a very complex world. There are a lot of other ways where things came out exactly the way she hoped because of what she did. For example, getting the sanctions against the nuclear Iran situation to bring them to the table. So it's a complex world, and it's Hillary versus someone. I would match her record on foreign policy against any Democrat or Republican in this race. She's the one that will protect our country. I have tremendous confidence.
Ellen Malcolm is founder of Emily's List. Her new book is Win, Women, Win. She's speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30, tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6:30. Ellen, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose. It's been fun.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the quality and safety of drinking water in the United States. The Flint water crisis has raised many questions about our drinking water. Roughly 96 million people could be drinking water with unsafe levels of lead, according to the American Water Works Association. So what will it take to overhaul the country's water infrastructure, which could cost $1 trillion over 25 years? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.